Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Good morning, everybody. 908 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin, and it is, believe it or not, is the fourth Wednesday today. I had to do the math, and that means fourth Wednesday. Zach Renstrom is here. Been a while, Zach. You doing all right?
Yeah, doing great.
Thank you for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
No, it's good to be here.
Baby blue. He's wearing baby blue today, folks. Looks good. Yeah. Zach is, of course, the... I always forget the official name. You're in charge of the Washington County Water Conservancy District, but that doesn't make you the president. Doesn't make you
general
the
manager.
General manager. That's the word. I don't know what it, you know. Yeah. He's. I always call him the water czar, which is it's fine. It's not an official title, but it's what I like to use. And water, of course, is coming up. You know, it's funny, Zach. I've been doing this show for 6 years. In fact, on February 1st will be my 6-year anniversary on the show. And you've been coming most of those.
Yeah.
Ron retired not long after I took over. Maybe he took a clue from Mike McGarry. He said, "Yeah, I'm done. Yeah, we're out of here." But and it seems like it maybe more shows than not we've talked about drought, and it's back in the forefront of our minds, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean it's crazy to me that I've not been in this position that long, maybe 5 years, like you said, and I have already witnessed the extremes. So we went 155 days without any measurable rainfall, the longest ever.
Mm-hmm.
So a record. Last year we hit record highs last summer.
Right.
This summer is looking like, well, right now, driest ever percentage-wise to this point. You know, hopefully we'll get some storms coming in here. But then flip side, 2 years ago, we had one of the best winters ever recorded for water.
Right.
And so just in a short time, I've had these extremes. But that's the desert.
And I guess that's the nature of your job, too,
yeah.
Right? Let's talk to Zach about the drought or the flood or whatever it is. So before we get into that a little more, I wanted to talk about this. Was really, it's been on my mind, and I've been wanting to ask you this for, I don't know, it's been 2 weeks now, week and a half now, the wildfires in California. We heard reports right after they really got going, especially in Pacific Palisades, of firefighters getting up there, turning hydrants on, and there being no water in the fire hydrants. As a person who is in the know on this kind of thing, what do you think happened there?
So, I mean, that was a major water fire. Like, I will say it was a significant one. There was, you know, all that stuff about it. And so the demand on the water system was extreme.
Okay.
However, with that said, in talking and associating with people that also run water systems in California, they are astronomically frustrated that they're not allowed to build infrastructure to deal with things. And so for, you know, I remember talking to an individual that there was an old water tank. He wanted just to remove the water tank and build a new one. And he was talking about how it was taking years of bureaucratic nightmare just to rebuild things down there. And so their engineers are not allowed to build infrastructures needed to deal with large, extremely events.
The weird thing is, Zach, it's not like they don't ever have wildfires. This happens every year.
Yeah.
So why? What's going on?
I'm not going to try to justify California, but I can tell you that talking to the engineers, they're frustrated that they feel like that they cannot build infrastructure to deal with those events.
And that includes reservoirs, right?
Reservoirs, wells, pipelines, all that stuff that as engineers we want to build to make sure they have the infrastructure they need to respond to these big extremes. They feel very frustrated that they can't. Now, with that said, I will say it was an extreme event. I mean, it would tax almost any water system because of the things. But like here, I actually think about these things of how we respond. I mean, there's certain areas of the county I would be more concerned about. I know their systems wouldn't be up to a big wildfire like that, but the core of our water system at the water district, we would be able to handle something like that.
So is there ever a possibility, and I wouldn't say ever, because, you know, obviously there's extreme events, but is there a possibility that our firefighters were to turn on a hydrant and have it be empty?
It depends on where they're at in the county. And so, like in St. George City, or, you know, in the systems that are connected. So, like, it's interesting because we have what's it's called SCADA. And so we track what's going on in the system. And so when there's a large event, let's say, the last one I really remember is when the chapel across the street from the temple caught on fire. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're trying to fight that big blaze. It's fascinating to see the system kick in. And so in that event, I mean, you're starting to turn on wells up in Snow Canyon. You have the water treatment plant kicking off.
Wow.
You have millions of gallons of tanks stored, everything. And so all of a sudden the system acts very dynamically to start pushing water to where the firefighters need it. And because we have a very robust infrastructure here, we can respond to those events. The little isolated systems that are smaller, they would struggle. They definitely would struggle on something like that because the infrastructure is just not as big.
Can you give us an example where that would be?
No.
No? Okay.
I don't want to throw anybody in the bus. But but all the systems are required to meet a minimum fire flow situation, which is generally saying you have 200,000 gallons of water stored in a gravity tank that could respond to an event. Mm. The problem is if you have a large
wire fire.
Thank you. and that 200,000 gallons, and let's say they have a small little well, they would struggle. So most systems are set up to fight a single house fire, but when it gets to a forest fire, those little systems would struggle a lot more.
I find this incredibly fascinating because that's something we don't think about. You know, you always talk about, you know, citizens don't want to think about the Water Conservancy District. They want to turn the tap water on and have drinkable water. It's the same thing with fires. We don't think about how much water that actually uses if there is a fire. And if we have, remember we had that fire just across the street here on the diagonal or Hope Street or whatever it was. We didn't think about the fact that they have to turn a hydrant on and it uses a lot of water to put out a fire. How much would, okay, you talked about a house fire. How much water does, say, an average house fire use? Do you know that number? And how does that compare to the average use of a regular house?
I don't know the average fire.
Okay.
House, but that's interesting. I'll look it up. But we do like those fire hydrants to have a minimum pressure, so we want them to have at least 30 psi, because those fire trucks, they actually start sucking water out of the hydrant. So it's just not the water flowing to them; they will actually suck it out.
Yeah.
And we don't want the pipes to go to a negative pressure, because then they will actually start sucking in contaminants. And so the state rule basically says that during a fire flow situation, they have to meet a minimum psi at a minimum flow for a duration of time. And I can say in our system, we could easily meet those requirements for much longer time, because it would just be a very dynamic system where the system senses that, hey, the water tank's going down, and it'll start flipping on pumps in different locations, and then it starts flipping on other things and going through.
Wow.
So, but those small systems that are just like maybe they have one well and one small little water tank, they would struggle.
Now, one of the things that it was pointed out to me, and I agree, there was a lot more ground, a lot more fuel for the fires in California. You go here, and especially, you know, in the rugged, rocky areas, we don't have a lot of ground fuel for the fire to burn. But there are areas, I mean, it seemed like not that long ago, and maybe it was a while ago now, there was a fire up Cedar Mountain, there was a fire down in the Kaibab, and there is a lot of fuel there. So, but I don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Zach, that we could have an event like Southern California here in Washington County too much, right?
So, I mean, in the lower elevations, there's just not as much vegetation. But in the higher elevations, like up on Kolob and Pine Valley, we have seen those big, massive water piles.
Okay.
That is one of our concerns, is in that we think about if there was a large fire above Zions National Park, we're talking a big one, there is a lot of fuel up there. Forest management's a whole other probably subject, but we haven't done a good job in the United States of managing our forests. But if there was a massive wildfire that went up there, what would happen to us come down here is because that changes the chemistry of the water if it's big enough. And so all of a sudden the water that we collect into our system, the chemistry changes. And so we have to have plans on how we would deal with the changing chemistry and how we would treat it. And sometimes there's nothing we could do except for let it just go down Lake Mead. And so that's one of those things that we have in our backup plans of what to do during a massive water fire and how we treat water.
Bottom line is, if I'm looking for peace of mind, if my house catches fire, we've got enough water to take care of that, unless it's a giant multi-house block wildfire thing.
If you're located in the center population of Washington County, then the water infrastructure is extremely robust and could deal with a massive fire that would go on. We'd have that fire. If you're located in the smaller systems that are located throughout the county, those systems would struggle. And so that's where you really should follow having that defensible space around your cabin or other things like that to deal with it. And make those appropriate steps.
There are pictures. I've seen many pictures of the wildfires in California, and you see isolated houses that didn't burn. Is that because of the defensible spaces mostly?
And building materials. And so.
Oh, okay.
You don't see it much here, but if you had a wood shingled roof, like those things, they just burn.
Yeah.
And so. I up on Kolob, we run a system up on Kolob, and so we are talking to, like, there's some developers that want to go in there, or just individuals that want to build cabins. And so one of the questions that come up on Kolob is the fire flow situation, because that system's small. That system would really struggle. And so one of the things that the fire marshal's talking to him about is saying, well, can you build these homes out of cinder blocks, you know, have metal roofs, keep
stuff
vegetation.
That doesn't burn.
Yeah. So if you have, you know, embers raining down on a metal roof, it's not going to do much. But if it's, you know, a different type of roof, like a wooden roof of any kind, then it's more susceptible. And so there's a lot of discussions about that.
When I went to Europe this past summer, and it was fascinating to look at the architecture. First of all, they take tremendous pride in their dwellings and things. But I learned, and I guess intuitively it makes sense, but if you didn't have a lot of money, you built your house out of wood. And if you had a lot of money, you built your house out of stone and rock and stuff. And so when fires came, you know, big cities burned in Europe and even in, you know, Chicago fire and New York fires. Cities burn because they're made mostly out of wood. But you don't ever see a castle burning down or a big giant dwelling burning down because they're not made out of wood.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. So, well, I do think, Zach, that it's comforting to know for most of us that live in a population center area. I do we're going to be okay if there's a fire. So I was curious. So the fire trucks hook into the hydrants, right? Mm-hmm. And like you said, they kind of suck water out and they get the high pressure going and put the. But what if it's a wildfire and they have to take what they call a water truck out there to put the fire? Where does that water come from? Is it something that's pre-filled? Did they stop at a hydrant along the way and fill it up? And then that's the only water they have, right?
Yeah, sometimes that's the case. When I was a county commissioner, I know we had a big fire up in Pine Valley and. Mm. And yeah, so those fire trucks, I mean, they turn into big water trucks and they fill them up with a couple thousand gallons of water and they drive up and they spray that and then they have to drive back to the next fire hydrant.
Get more water.
Of course, during those big fires, they dip water out of the lakes and reservoirs and they're allowed to do that. And we encourage them to do that because that is a source of source to put the fire out, water. So we just work with them as much as we can. And so, yeah, and sometimes, especially those wildfires, that's all they have.
If we have a fire and we have the aircraft come and they get water out of the lakes and stuff, will that affect our water supply at all if that were to ever happen? Seems like they don't take that much.
They don't. But. Yeah, from a statistical standpoint, I mean, they're taking a small percentage of the amount of water. And so, like, when they were dipping out of some of our lakes, the amount that they were taking, it was such a small amount, we couldn't even really register on our gauges. Mm-hmm. And so.
Okay. I had heard that the problem California had, well, the many of the problems California had, but one of them was that they had a really wet season and then it dried out. And that's why there was so much vegetation from the wet season and then it dried out and it became, you know, like I said, fuel for the fires. Is that kind of what happened too?
That's what I heard too. I mean, I'm not a fire person, but in hearing that, you have to manage your vegetation, especially in those locations. So
I remember going up, gosh, it's been 4 or 5 years. My wife and I drove up on Cedar Mountain. It was after they had the wildfires, mm-hmm. and the mountainsides were, you know, almost barren, you know, just burnt out husks of trees and no vegetation on the ground. And then you start getting into the whole, well, now we have mudslides and problems mm-hmm. like that. In fact, California issued a warning today to be prepared for possible mudslides if this storm does bring a lot of rain that's coming. And that's a whole nother animal, I guess.
Yeah.
So.
And all the ash. Yeah.
Yeah. It's scary stuff. All right, so far as fire is concerned here in southern Utah, we're okay unless it's something gigantic.
Gigantic from a water quality, or if you live in those rural spaces.
All right, very good. Okay, I wanted to talk a couple of other things. Let's start with, we'll save the drought for after the weather break.
Okay.
Let's start with the legislature and water bills and things that you're keeping an eye on. The legislature started, Utah State Legislature started yesterday. What are you keeping an eye on with those guys?
So it's interesting because when I first, you know, started getting involved with the water board and everything like that, there's usually like maybe one or two bills dealing with water.
Not many, yeah.
Right now there's 10. And it's only started. And so some bills, they're just kind of all over. And one thing I've learned with the legislature is someone introduce a bill, and that doesn't there's so many variables with that and where they go and how they get through committee and everything like that. And so I just kind of read the bills. I reach out to our representatives here locally and give them my feedback. And they're excellent. They work very, very hard. And then we just kind of see how the bills go through and add where we can and just go and basically tell the representative saying, hey, here's the consequences of the bill. I don't like telling them what to do. I just tell them, hey, this, if you do this, this is the consequence. If you do this, this is the consequence, because that's all my job is to go to them and give them the best advice possible, but not tell them.
So Adam Snow yesterday, we didn't really have time to get into it, but he mentioned that they're talking about water in the Great Salt Lake. And I said, well, you know, Southern Utahns don't really care that much, right, about the Great Salt Lake. And we don't, but it does involve us sort of, right, in the where they get that water from. Tell us about that.
So a lot of the water on the Wasatch Front actually comes from the Colorado River. And so they take water out of the Colorado River, the Colorado River drainage basin, stick it in Strawberry Reservoir, and then through a series of tunnels and channels and canals, they actually bring that water over to the Wasatch Front.
Wow.
And so, of course, we're on the Colorado River, and so it all interacts together, essentially, and how it works. And then the big thing that I do, part of this legislation, is there will be a bill that's proposed. And in that bill, it'll be talking about the Great Salt Lake, but it would have very negative consequences for southern Utah. And so a lot of my time, I should say, is going up there and saying, listen, hey, I don't have an issue with this bill. I don't, you know, this bill's good policy for Salt Lake, but it's not good policy for southern Utah. And I explained that, and I spent a lot of time there. And I will say every time I've met with the legislator where I kind of explain our unique situation down here, they've always been really good about working with us on that.
That's good.
Like reuse is a good example. Like up there, reuse is not good for some various reasons. Where down here, it's very, very good, and they want to promote it. So it's just kind of things we work through.
Is it as simple with the Great Salt Lake as if they take, the more they take, the less we get? Is it that simple?
No. It's actually fairly complex, but the Great Salt Lake has some issues dealing with that. They have to maintain certain levels in the lake for the economy, essentially, because they have massive, it's in the billions of dollars from the brine shrimp, the minerals, and all that stuff. Even with the Great Salt Lake, it was very fascinating that one time I get this, the Olympic Committee asked us to come and meet with them. I'm like, why does the Olympic Committee want to meet?
Seriously.
Well, they sit down with, when I say sit down with us, there's the four water districts, and they sit down with us and they're like, listen, we cannot have the Great Salt Lake dried up during the Olympics.
It's got to have water because all these people are coming.
And they talk to us about the optics and everything. So they're like, how are we going to solve this problem? And so we can talk to them about it and options about it. And so, but yeah, a lot of, like, they need to get more, they need to deal with the lake up there, and they haven't.
So explain to me, I'm a dumb guy, to me, you always talk about what's in the water and is it usable. Well, the Great Salt Lake is famous for being notoriously salty.
Sure.
Seemingly, to the average person, unusable water for the public. Is that true? And if it is, then what will putting regular fresh water in it do for, how will that, I guess I just don't understand.
So in the Great Salt Lake, why they need to keep it up is basically three reasons. First of all, like I said, the brine shrimp, which is a huge business, the minerals.
So people actually by the brine shrimp. It's sure. Actually, I mean, isn't it like really tiny? Like,
yeah. But if you
what
have,
what do
fish,
they do with it?
Well, if you have fish food for your aquarium, some of that's brine shrimp. Okay. They use brine shrimp all over.
Okay,
it was I
you
saw
won't
it.
Get it at Sizzler, but it's right. Yeah, okay.
But it's used all over. They do take a ton of minerals out of the Great Salt Lake, and they have mm-hmm. to have a certain amount of water for that. And then the other then you have a dust issue going on up there. If it dried that's up, true. You would have a lot more dust coming in. Then they also have, especially towards Willard Bay and also where the Bear River comes in, the Farmington Bay, they have, it's a major area for birds, flying up to Canada back. So you have a big environmental issue there. The other thing is so that you have the lake effect snow. And so if the Great Salt Lake dries up, the Wasatch Front would actually lose that lake effect snow, which would make them actually drier for the farmers. And so there's all these things that they have to consider.
And the ski resorts, by the way.
And the ski resorts,
they
yeah.
They want snow.
They want snow. Oh, yeah. And I mean, that's a big deal. And so, but there's been evidence that the lake has dried up before. And so... during a really, 1,000 years ago, there was some evidence that shows that it completely dried up. And so how much of this is just a cycle? How much is this caused by, diverting water out of the Great Salt Lake? And yeah.
You're a geologist a little bit, right? You Lake Bonneville and the lake, the shoreline marks on the valley and stuff. And last time I had my dad up there, we talked a lot about that.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
The fact that, that whole valley used to be covered in water.
Yeah.
And then I don't know how many thousands of years ago that was, but it was a while ago.
Then a dike broke and drained it.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating.
9:30 on KDXU. We're going to talk with Zach about the drought. When we come back, he is the general manager of the Washington County Water Conservancy District. We'll be right back.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
It's Wednesday on the Andy Griffin Show. Zach Renstrom is here. He is the general manager of the Washington County Water Conservancy District and a man who always seems to be on the hot seat. Someone's always got a drought's going on, man. It's drought. You're stealing water from there. Everybody's always throwing stuff at you, but you catch most of it and throw it back. So that's good.
Yeah.
Doing a good job there.
Well, thanks.
All right. So a couple of dates in history. How about 1895? How about 1934? Those were droughts, major, major droughts in the state of Utah. We are not there. No, not yet. But it's always a possibility and certainly something I guess you think about a little bit, Zach, huh?
Yeah, especially this year with our snowpack. Like, we're only at 29% of average.
And by we, you mean southern Utah,
southern,
right?
Just basically just the Virgin River Basin.
Okay.
And, I mean, so it's in about 5 days, we're going to be in record territory of being the lowest that it's ever been
unless,
for that particular day.
Unless,
yeah. I guess there's some clouds coming in.
Yeah, yeah. And we're hopeful that this weekend we actually get some storms. And it doesn't have to rain down here necessarily, right? We need snow up there.
Yeah, really. I mean, if you look up and you see Pine Valley Mountain, we want that sucker white up there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so down here, it helps a little bit. It does. But really, we need that moisture up there in the mountains above Zions and up in Pine Valley.
Now, talk about soil saturation. I know you've mentioned it in the past, and I've had a couple of people mention it, but maybe we don't quite understand the concept. Can you explain that concept of the soil, whether it's saturated or not?
Yeah, so it is extremely important we measure it at different depths about this, how much moisture is in the soil. And so before that we get any water basically for us to use down here, the plants and the soils and stuff like that, they have to reach a certain saturation before we actually see runoff in the stream coming through.
Okay.
And also that soil saturation also helps with our aquifers. That's what recharges our aquifer. And so, like, right now the soil moisture is really low. Like I said, we're actually in record territory. And so if we do get a little bit of snow, the soil will just suck that up immediately. Mm-hmm. And then the plants of just the, wildlife up there, the wild plants, they suck up that first. And so we have to almost reach a certain level before we actually start seeing more water in the river. Mm-hmm. And so what we really, really need is we need one of those 3 days soakers where it just comes in, it just kind of rains for 3 days, snows up in the mountain for like 3 days, then it clears up for about 5 days, lets some of the snow melt, gets the soil saturated, and then we get another storm in. And that a couple of years ago, that's exactly what happened. We just got in this pattern of we'd get a couple of good days and then it would pull off and it'd come back in. And that's what we really need. We need like five of those good storms.
Have you become a weather watcher? Are you a guy that, you know, and maybe you pull the old farmer's almanac out and you start studying the climatology of what's happened in the past and you start looking at the storms that are off the coast and you're like, is that part of what you do now?
Yeah. So I don't look at the farmer's almanac. I have to admit. Don't tell my uncle that because he loves it. But I do go in and look at what's going on. So once a month we get a report from NOAA saying this is kind of the forecast for the next 30 days of how, you know, the jet stream's behaving. And so we look at that because we think about how to operate our system. And so right now we're entering a drought mode scenario where we're like, yeah, we might get a little bit of moisture in here. But I'm telling everybody, like, hey, this summer could be tough. And so let's start operating our system that way. And so that's how we're kind of managing everything from the river to our lakes to our treatment plant.
Do you get people asking you, are we going to make it? How are we going to make it? But people are, you know, the growth and the developing, and how can we provide them water when we don't even know if we have enough for us? Do you hear that a lot?
Oh, almost every day.
Yeah. Okay. And what do you tell them?
Well, so like right now this summer, our reservoirs are sitting, well, Sand Hollow and Quail combined, there's 75% full. So we have really good water storage capacity. So like this summer, even if we get no more precipitation, we're going to have safe drinking water this summer, and we're going to have room for growth. And even with that, if you go out to Sand Hollow Reservoir when it's full, there's about 50,000 acre feet of water. Well, the district has put into the ground underneath Sand Hollow 150, so three times the size of Sand Hollow has now been put underground, and we have wells all around there, so we could also pull all that. Because we know that there's going to be this, you know, we knew we were going to have a hot, dry winter, summer, and we need to prepare for that. And so we have been preparing for that. And so we're responding to that. And that's what we built this infrastructure for. So moving forward to make sure that we never run out of water, that's why we're building Chief Toker Reservoir right now. And that's why we're working on the Warner Valley land transfer right now. And so we will keep up those plans. If 2 years ago when it was so wet and we had such a great year, if I would have had all the reservoirs that we're thinking about building right now, we would have had every one of those completely full. And then we could have carried that water into, like right now when we're going into a drought scenario. So we have to build this infrastructure.
What does the change in executive administration in our country affect you on a daily basis? Are things going to change a little bit?
That's what we're all trying to figure out.
Okay.
And so it's tough because, I'm talking to our congressional delegation. Because this is one of the things, it's like, you know, I'll pick on the DMV. We all hate going to the DMV to get a driver's license.
Yeah.
And so if you come in, you fire, say, half the staff at the DMV, well, I still have to have a driver's license or when I get pulled over by the cops. Right now, I still have to get a piece of paper from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, from the Army Corps of Engineers, from the Bureau of Reclamation. I have to fulfill all these requirements. And so, yeah, even if we get rid of half of them, I still have to get tons of paperwork. And so I'm hoping Congress will come in and say, no, we're going to streamline this process and make it a lot easier for you, and this is how we're going to do it. And that's where we really need. And I would even say that's a bipartisan issue now, because even the Democratic parties is recognizing that we have to have more streamlined permitting process. Because, you know, taking 20 years, Chief Toker Reservoir took us 20 years to get a permit. And you can't do that.
Yeah.
To have a successful
political economy. Not if we want to drink in 10 years.
Yeah. And I think years. This is, I mean, I, like we talked about California, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, their engineers are pulling their hairs out saying, we wanted to build more water tanks, we wanted to build more pipelines, we wanted to build all this stuff, and they weren't able to because it takes 20 years.
And then something happens, everybody blames them, and even though they were like, we told you, we tried.
Yeah, so all right. It's tough.
I got a text here. Good morning. Are you aware that the city has been trying to solve the origin of groundwater coming out of the area at the corner of Indian Hills Drive and Valley View? Do you know anything about this?
Indian Hills and Valley View. So there is So there are individual springs that pop up all over this area. I mean, that's one of the reasons why the Mormon pioneers settled in this area, because there is groundwater, and sometimes it is shallow. In fact, if you go to the new county building, right in their parking lot, when they were building the building, they found an old historical well.
Really?
And it wasn't that deep. The old St. George Temple, they had groundwater problems there. And so they do have a lot of these little pockets where the groundwater kind of comes up and causes problems for settling, or there's a lot of issues. Depending on the location, though, where he's at, that water probably is not good enough to drink. It's TDS, total dissolved solids, and so it probably has too many dissolved solids.
Okay. I've never heard that term. All the years you've been coming, you've never TDS'd me. Total dissolved solids?
TDS. That's a big deal in my world.
Just really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we have standards that we have to meet. And there are health implications towards that number. And so we try to keep that number as low. So like, for example, seawater or the ocean has a very high TDS.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you can swim in it. You can recreate it. You can do all that. But if you drink it, it kills you, right?
Oh, you don't want that.
And so we have strict rules about how much, and it's good, about how high the TDS can get.
I had, by the way, this one has nothing to do with you. Another text that said, why is Robert De Niro on your station? We are playing a commercial where Robert De Niro talks during the commercial. It is a paid advertisement, and we have zero control over that being on there. But definitely his politics are a little different than ours here in Southern Utah. Okay, so let's do this. Let's get another break in.
Okay.
And again, we'll talk some more about the drought and what needs to happen and what kind of shape we're in. I also had a little follow-up on our old friend, the Lake Powell Pipeline, because some people say that the people opposed to the Northern Corridor, a lot of them are the same people that almost killed, maybe at least postponed for a long time, the Lake Powell Pipeline. So
okay,
we'll talk about that when we come back. Stay with us, folks.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk leader.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention Nanta. You're welcome to call in to me or Zach Renstrom, our Washington County Water Conservancy District General Manager, anytime you want, 673-5890. We got about 12 minutes left in the show, and we'd love to get your call in. We got a few texts. If you'd rather text, you can text me at 467-5842. Those are both 435 area codes. So to call 673-5890, to text 467-5842. All right, Zach, I'm going to ask it right out. If we don't get any really significant rain until next fall, are we okay?
Yes.
Yes. The answer, short answer, is yes.
And you can go out there and look at Sand Hollow Reservoir, and you see all that water sitting there, and that's why.
Okay. If
now the farmers are going to struggle this summer if we don't get some rain.
If we don't get significant rain, what will Sand Hollow shrink?
Oh, yes.
Will it be, you know, half of what it is, or a third, or two-thirds of what it is? Or
Yeah. It could go down significantly. If we don't get anything, it would go down substantially. And so the amount of area that you could recreate on, the number of boats that could be on there would be reduced substantially if we don't get some rain.
Okay. And swimmer's itch might go up too. Who knows? But
it probably would.
Ron Thompson always used to say, well, there's always February and March, right, as far as rains and spring showers and all that stuff. Are you optimistic? Do you feel like it's going to happen? An educated guess, I guess, is what I'm asking for.
So I don't have a mathematical guess for you, but I am an optimistic person in general.
Okay.
And I think that we still have some time in this year to see what happens. And Ron actually, he came into the office and he's like, don't worry, Zach. You know, if it's dry in the fall, it always gets us in the spring. And I'm like, okay, so I'm optimistic it'll come through. But it's always still good to know we've got that water sitting there.
Okay, real quick updates. We've got about less than 10 minutes. Let's get some updates on potential reservoirs in the future. You talked about the process, all the permits and all the studies and things that have to happen. How far away and are there more reservoirs coming?
Yeah, I mean, so Chief Toker, our board just issued the construction of that, the bid on that. And so you're going to start seeing some really big trucks. I mean, that was a $40 million contract that is going to get going. We have a graveyard over by Santa Clara.
We're still trying to rename them, but yeah.
Talk to Michelle Randall.
Mayor Randall, I should say.
Okay.
I even told her we should name it Randall Reservoir, if nothing else. Okay. She's like, no. So we need to come up with a better name.
Or Mayor Rosenberg, too, because it's really next to
I actually threatened. I said, okay, how about Rosenberg Reservoir? He said, no, absolutely not. I'm thinking Hafen Lake, because they were the original owners of that land.
And I think that'd be cool. Yeah. But see, we have tons of pieces of paper, but I'm still waiting for one piece of paper on that.
From?
The Army Corps of Engineers. Okay. But we're getting closer.
At least it's not an environmental group. Or is it? Kind of. Okay.
But on that one, it's all designed. It's ready to go. Once we get that piece of paper, we can.
Well, will that be the next one, do you think?
I think so.
After Chief Toker?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Then Cove Reservoir, which is located above Zions National Park. The draft EIS hopefully will be coming out here in the next 3 or 4 months.
Environmental impact, by the way.
Oh, yes. Thank you. And so after that goes through that, the whole system, and like I said, we don't know exactly what's going to happen with the new administration, but we'd love to see that that project kicking off. Kolob Reservoir, hopefully in about 5 years-ish, we're going to be hopefully raising that by 8 feet and having some more storage there. And then
are there buildings close to that would affect? No?
No, we definitely have to work with some landowners, and it would affect some of the camping around there, but that's one of those things we'd have to look into. And then, of course, Warner Valley, the EA for the land exchange was put out, and the BLM right now is responding to the comments that came in. And so hopefully the district will own the land for Warner Valley here in about 6 months.
Okay.
So,
but we're looking at a long time down the road, because then you still have to do all the other stuff. Right?
Yeah. And I mean, even with Chief Toker, even after we got all the permits and it was like, yeah, you can go and start building it. I mean, it takes years to build these infrastructure projects. And like I said, you know, Chief Toker, it's $40 million to build just a portion of it. We've already done a lot of work on it. And so they do take years to construct, too. And then you just can't fill them up instantly. You have to, when it's a new dam, you have to fill them in a certain very specific way. So
what do you mean specific way? It only take a percentage of the creek or whatever?
Well, yeah, you want to slowly bring those up, and then you want the soils to saturate, and then you slowly bring them up and saturate and slowly. And stuff like that. And so each dam has a personality, and so you have to work with the personality of that. And so you don't know the personality of a dam until it's built.
Makes sense. Even though it kind of sounds funny, it kind of makes sense, right?
Like Sand Hollow, man, that is a great reservoir. Like we fill that 100% full, and it's just perfect.
Happy as can be.
As happy. In fact, it almost responds better when it's full. Hmm. Where Quell, we always are a little bit nervous about Quell, and so that's why we rarely will ever fill Quell to 100%.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, because we have all these sensors all over the dams, and then we start seeing things, and we're like, well, it's one of those things that we have to be hypersensitive, hypersafe, and so we just work with that.
Is that at all related to that dam actually broke many 40 years ago?
So, I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Short answer. I don't want a dam should not break, in my opinion. It just shouldn't. And so we spent a lot of time and effort to make sure that doesn't happen. So now we just don't have one engineering firm come in. We have one engineering firm come in and review the dam yearly. And then we have a complete separate dam engineering firm come in and review it, and then we still have dam safety. And so we work with almost three separate entities making sure that they all say it's safe, and then we have people on those dams every day.
Okay, I got to ask about this because it's been brought up. Lake Powell pipeline, is it 100% dead?
In Utah state statute, there's the Lake Powell Pipeline Act, and so the Utah state legislature has still directed the state of Utah to construct the Lake Powell Pipeline.
Okay.
With that said, there's a lot of things that have to happen before that. There's negotiation going on the Colorado River. There's even some litigation going on the Colorado River, and so a lot of things have to be resolved before the state of Utah could really go back and start diving into designing that. And so the district's 20-year plan, the Lake Powell pipeline is not included in our 20-year plan.
So if it ever happens, it's not going to be in the next 20 years?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You're a lawyer. You mentioned the litigation. Is some litigation a little frivolous, or is it legit stuff?
It's complex.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot of litigation, and some of it's just frivolous, of like some environmental group suing because they didn't think, you know, I mean, that was a whole other thing. But some of it's like, hey, there's competing water interests on the basically the river, and we need to resolve some of those. And some of those have to do with tribal water and how those are going to be resolved too.
Okay. So,
yeah.
Zach here from the Water Conservancy District. We've gotten down to the last 3 or 4 minutes. He said right here, we're going to be okay with water this year, even if it doesn't rain more. What about next year?
So even with next year, we, like I said, we have all that groundwater stored underneath Sand Hollow Reservoir that we could start tapping into.
If we have to.
If we had to. Okay. And so we do have that plan, but it's one of those things, the longer we go, I get more nervous. And so even with that, though, is we do have an emergency operation plan, a water shortage plan. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a drought plan. Let's say there's an earthquake and everything. So we do have a plan that would outline of like, okay, how would we reduce demand to make sure? Because we have to have safe drinking water. That's not an option not to have it.
Yeah.
And so our plan kind of comes in and says, okay, we need to start taking these steps to make sure we're safe.
By the way, just a personal experience with water meters. So we got our water bill last month, and we had used, it wasn't a gigantic number, but it was, you know, double or triple what we normally use. And so we're like, we've got a leak. Well, so St. George City, I live in St. George City. They're doing it kind of neighborhood at a time with the smart meters. Our neighborhood has not, we don't have them yet. Yeah. But when we called in and say, hey, we're worried about our water bill. It's more than it's supposed to be. We think we have a leak. St. George City came out that day or maybe the next day and put in a smart meter. Uh-huh. And we were able to see, and it was like 10 gallons an hour, which is, you know, it's not a ton, but it's something, you know, you wonder what's going on. And so we were able to figure out where our water leak was. And
where was it?
It was, we have a little pond fountain thing in our backyard, and the float thing had broken. And so it thought it was always needing water, and then it was leaking through a little crack into the yard, and probably would eventually have made a sinkhole or something after enough time. But so we are addressing that. In fact, we have the water and the outside water completely turned off, shut off, and while we get that fixed. But you know, it's one of those things you don't think about, but when you live in a desert like we do, Zach, you need to think about it. Am I using, and it really didn't cost, expense wise, it wasn't much more money, right? Yeah. But it was enough to go, okay, something's not right. And so I can appreciate the fact that you have been a proponent of the water meters and of conserving water, and it made both my wife and I very aware, okay, we need to figure this out.
Yeah,
so that's pretty cool.
It is fascinating to see when that leak, I have seen cases where they turn into massive amount of money or damage, because I've seen water actually from a leak go under, you know, it goes into the ground, it goes underneath a neighbor's house, and then pops up like two houses down and cause damage. And it was a lawsuit that I was part of as an expert witness, but it was fascinating to track that water back. And so some of those leaks and those leak detections are quite good. So
could have been really, you're saying, disastrous.
Oh yeah,
if we hadn't figured it out.
Yeah, I've seen cinder block walls just crumble because of water hydrostatic pressure and other things like that. And so the leak detection, not only is it saving water, but it should help with, you know, people's damages, water damages, sinkholes and stuff like that are settling.
It's funny, my wife said, you know, you can tell when like someone takes a shower in our house, what time they're in the shower and stuff. And and I said, yeah, big deal. And she goes, well, I've been watching these true crime stories, and what if somebody gets a hold of the information that I'm naked in the shower at a certain time, and they attack and come in the house, and you're not home? And anyway, that's kind of funny. So
I've never thought.
By the way, that information is not available.
It's not public.
It's not like anybody can drive by and go, oh, they're in the shower. No, that doesn't work that way. So.
Well, that's interesting stuff.
Zach Frenstrom, we are okay water-wise this year. It would be nice if it would rain. But even without rain, we're going to be all right.
Exactly. We will.
All right. We're out of time. Zach, thanks for coming today. Great to talk to you. Tomorrow we'll be talking with a couple of folks with St. George City about budget and new businesses and that kind of stuff. It should be fun. Join me then. Thanks for listening. I'm Andy. We'll see you later.